Our first case this morning is 11-1383, State of Ohio versus Kyle Raber. For the appellant, Mr. Eager.
Chief Justice O'Connor, Justices of the Court, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes in rebuttal, which will be handled by co-counsel David Todaro. May it please the Court, when does a criminal case end? This Court ruled in State v. Carlisle that reaffirmed longstanding Ohio law by a 7-0 vote. It established a bright-line rule that a trial court does not have jurisdiction or authority to reopen and review its own judgment after final appealable order has been journalized.
Counsel, could you help us with one issue that I'm not sure is agreed to by the parties? Counsel for the state maintains that there was a waiver or consent to deferring this matter to a later point in time. And if that is so, does that not make this case sort of one of a kind that doesn't fit in our jurisprudence?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm aware of that position of the state, and I believe it doesn't impact this case at all, simply because the issue at play here is whether there's subject matter jurisdiction for the court to reopen the case as it did. As this court is aware, subject matter jurisdiction is not an issue that can be waived by any party. It's always in play and can be brought up at the first time on appeal.
Well, was there or was there not an agreement to defer this issue to a later point in time?
I don't believe there was, Your Honor. I believe at the sentencing hearing, there was a discussion about an evidentiary hearing on the issue of consent, which was unresolved. And the trial court asked both parties to submit briefs on the issue. The state of Ohio did not submit a brief nor do anything else. 5 days later, the court issued its ruling, which became a final appealable order.
Would it be final if it wasn't complete?
I'm sorry?
Would it be a final order if it wasn't complete?
I believe it would be, Your Honor.
Isn't there a mandatory duty to make that determination?
I don't believe the issue.
It says shall.
True, but the issue of sex offender registration was undetermined. As this case involved an issue of consent, much like in State v. Battistelli, the hearing should have been held to determine that because there was a chance, if it was deemed consensual, that he would not have to register under the exception in SB 10 of 2950.01b. It's there for that reason. Battistelli lays the roadmap for the state to follow in that case. In Battistelli, it was very similar. There was an issue of consent on the crime that was charged and the gentleman was convicted of. The trial court in Battistelli asked for briefs on whether or not he had to register or whether there should be a hearing on consent. They submitted briefs. The trial court then took it under advisement, had a sentencing a month or so later, made its ruling, determined there did not need to be an evidentiary hearing, and ruled that he did not have to register. The state of Ohio in Battistelli then timely appealed that decision because it was unsatisfied. It took it to the Ninth District that remanded it to have the evidentiary hearing.
Wasn't there a hearing in this case?
There was a hearing, Your Honor.
On the issue of consensual or non-consensual?
Yes, there was. However, the whole thing is there was no jurisdiction for the court to reopen. In Battistelli, they submitted briefs. There was a sentencing entry. The court denied the issue of evidentiary hearing. The state timely appealed, kept jurisdiction in play, took it to the Ninth, who sent it back down. Here, no appeal.
Was there a motion filed to reopen this case?
There was no motion filed.
Well, how do you say it's a reopening? It was never closed.
I think that's closed.
The point of Justice Pfeiffer and the Chief Justice's question. It's a continuing hearing in the Common Pleas Court, and it's never been closed, and there can't be any reopening of something that wasn't closed.
I guess that's the gist of our argument, Your Honor, is that there was a final order issued. It was journalized by the clerk. As this court has long held, a final judgment entry that's journalized becomes a final appealable order. And if the 30 days runs out for appeal, the case is closed then. So this case was closed. It was reopened improperly, much like in Carlisle. Carlisle, at least a motion was filed, even though it was deemed a nullity. So this case is even more egregious than that. Carlisle is the bright line rule moving forward for everyone to know, to keep a level playing field for all parties to understand. This is going to help the lower courts, as well as prosecutors and defense attorneys, and the defendants understand the way to keep a case alive is to do the procedural things that are set forth.
Isn't this
in the rules.
Just a very fact-specific case? This is such an anomaly to have a sentence imposed, an entry signed by the judge, and yet we still have this unfinished business that we have to address, and that's the registration issue. I mean, who does that? That is just so abnormal in the process, is it not?
I agree. This is a different case to the extent that things happen that shouldn't have. But there's procedures in place. Criminal Rule 32C, you got the issue of appeal that could have occurred. If the state was unsatisfied with that December 1, 2008 entry, if they felt something was missing, then they needed to do something. They could have objected at sentencing, saying, we got to do a hearing.
Have two trial judges involved, right?
Yes.
The first trial judge took the matter of the consensual nature of the activity under advisement and never made a ruling. Is that right?
His entry is silent on that issue, Your Honor.
What does the entry say?
The entry lists a finding of guilt. It lists a sentence of 60 days in jail, a fine, some probation. He signs it, and then it's journalized by the court. Okay. A court, as we all know...
There was no sex offender registration on that entry.
There was nothing on that entry regarding sex offender registration. As we know, courts speak only through their journal.
Or did the court not take that matter under advisement?
I don't believe it did. I believe it was undetermined. They wanted a brief. No briefs were submitted. He issued his ruling.
How did the case get transferred to a different common pleas court judge?
When it apparently was reopened for some status conference in October of 2009, Judge Brown, I believe, transferred it to the desk of Judge Mark Weiss.
Was your client incarcerated at that point?
No. He'd already served his 60 days and was out back in college.
Mr. Eager, isn't part of this concern res judicata, the idea of a defendant being sentenced at a specific time, serving the sentence, and then later on, 2 years later, the judge attempting to add to the sentence that was already completed?
Yes, we believe that, Your Honor. And it's, again, as this court has determined last year in Williams, SB 10 is punitive. It is a punitive statute. It's no longer the civil remedial thing we saw with Megan's Law. There are further restraints and restrictions on one's freedom. This would be more akin to post-release control. The idea of that is to put a defendant on notice before he goes in to be incarcerated, that there'll be further restrictions on where he can live, where he can work, where he can go to school. None of that was done here. Now the court's trying to open it back up, bring it back to where they can add further punishment without authority or jurisdiction to do so. The state didn't like it. The state could have appealed the decision. It had time. They did it in Battistelli. They did it right in Battistelli.
So, counsel, I guess I want to follow up on what the Chief Justice said, because it feels like when you read the briefs, there's something missing. Judges have enough work to do. So there is an entry put on. The defendant serves his sentence, and for some unknown reason, just 11 months later, a new judge decides, I want to reopen this case? What's missing there? What was the intervening event? The state never appealed, no objections filed, and 11 months later a new judge just says, oh, I've got this case, let me reopen it and do a hearing.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's my understanding in the procedural aspect of this case and talking with those involved at the local level that it was the family of the victim who consistently contacted the prosecutor's office wondering why Kyle Raber was not on the web as a sex offender. They kept calling, kept at it, and then the court reopened it for whatever reason and then transferred it to another judge, and again, with no authority to do so.
That's why we have res judicata and finality and appeals, and it seemed to me, again, if we don't have an appeal, when they were invited to submit briefs and didn't, and the entry was then put on when no one submitted briefs, it seems to me there seemed... you know, I understand the point you're trying to make, that you can't just forever wait and then all of a sudden open up a case because somebody forgot to do something that the court invited briefs on. So I guess I'm concerned about the res judicata issue, as Justice Lansinger is.
Yes, and I agree, Your Honor, and thank you. And that's really the issue here. The state of Ohio and Raber did nothing that was available to it. It was unhappy with the entry. It could have done many things, and it did nothing. Battistelli, they did everything. They submitted briefs. The judge made a ruling. They didn't like it. They appealed it. They kept it in play. They brought it back, and it was handled properly. It was an even playing field for all parties. Here, the state didn't submit a brief. The state didn't appeal. The state didn't even appeal to the judge saying, hey, we've missed something. Let's do an amendment. Let's do a nunk-pro-tunk. Nothing was done. Then the case pops up, and here we are, you know, 11
months later. There was a notice afforded the defendant at the time of sentencing that registration is a component here. Is there?
No, actually, no. It was not, Your Honor. The discussions at sentencing hearing was whether there was going to be an evidentiary hearing on the issue of consent. So it wasn't mandated that he was going to have to register.
Well, I didn't say it was mandated. I said there was a notice that he would potentially have a registration requirement provided the subsequent hearing on the issue or the element of consensuality was determined.
Yeah, there was discussion on the record at the sentencing that there may be an evidentiary hearing on consent.
Wasn't there an evidentiary hearing on consent?
Later, yes, in 2010.
Okay.
Well after the case had been finalized.
Okay.
And that's our whole point, is that everything that happened in 2009, 2010 is a nullity. Subject matter jurisdiction, which cannot be waived and always subject to challenge, even on appeal for the first time.
You were not representing Mr. Raber at the time?
No. Attorney Tadaro and I took the case on appeal when things wrapped up on the evidentiary hearing.
And the defendant then was of the impression that, well, I guess we're not going to have that hearing that the judge mentioned at sentencing. He just went on with his life. Is that correct?
Yes. He, after the sentencing, he went and served his 60 days in jail. He got out, went back to school, served his probation, paid his fines. You know, didn't really give it another thought, just moving forward with his life. And all of a sudden, he's hailed back in the court. And, you know, quite frankly, his head was spinning as to why he was back. And things happened as they did. And they came to us on appeal saying, how can they do this? And, you know, here we are today. We did timely appeal the evidentiary hearing and the finding of he had to register. Again, something that the state never did.
Mr. Eager, is sex registration different than post-release control? Because if you were arguing post-release control under the case law that's out there, you would lose.
I understand that, Your Honor, and I was just, I guess, using post-release control as an example earlier as a type of thing that a court can go back on. No, sex offender registration, I believe, is not a post-release control issue. What started once years ago as a civil administrative matter to put the public on notice, has obviously turned into something a little more draconian and now punitive, but it's not post-release control. It is often deemed a civil proceeding is set forth in Claiborne, but Claiborne also establishes that it's a civil proceeding within the confines of a criminal case. The criminal case controls for time constraints, filing of appeal. If you recall, in Claiborne, the defendant appealed his conviction well after the 40 days had passed, and he felt it was more civil, so he had extra time. This court said, no, we don't give him separate dockets. It's within the criminal case. It's a separate proceeding, but it follows the criminal case in terms of time frames, deadlines.
Does our decision in Hernandez have any application here?
On the issue of Hernandez, which was argued also in Zaleski, where they went back and resentenced a defendant who was still incarcerated because his final post-release control was incorrect. Zaleski had ruled that it could do that, resentence to remedy the situation because he was still incarcerated. In Hernandez versus Kelly, it was a similar case. The defendant was incarcerated still. His judgment entry was silent on post-release control, which under his conviction was mandated. He was released from prison. then picked up later by the adult parole authority who claimed he violated a purported portion of his post-release control. He then sued this court for a writ of habeas, and this court determined that since he was no longer incarcerated, there was no remedy available for the court and ordered his release. I think that's where we are here, Your Honor. We got a bright line rule for Carlisle that sets a level playing field. What's good for the goose...
Counsel, but for the alleged agreement between the defense counsel and the prosecutor that and the judge, that we will continue this for this particular issue, I'd say Hernandez, you know, should control here, or it's a great starting point. But the question is the consent by the defendant and the state to revisit this, or to visit it, not revisit it, but visit it. And the only issue then becomes the time lag of 11 months or whatever the time span was between the original agreement and the ability to revisit, or your argument that you can't waive jurisdiction, this is a jurisdictional issue, and even though there may have been an agreement there, it has no force or effect.
Exactly, Your Honor. There's lots of case law that talks about parties can't agree to extend it. Courts can't order an extension or expansion of jurisdiction. It cannot be acquiesced by sitting on your hands. It exists by law, and if a court acts without authority, any proclamations or rulings made thereafter are a nullity.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Desiderio?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jason Desiderio. Excuse me. My name is Jason Desiderio. I represent the state of Ohio. I believe Justice Pfeiffer and Justice O'Neill and the Chief Justice have hit the point right on the head, really. If you refer to the transcript from the sentencing on November 26, the court says, can we, by agreement, take the issue under advisement and allow counsel to brief it so that, you know, we can, because I think it'll come down to whether or not it's a preponderance, whether or not it's clear and convincing. Is that agreeable?
Well, that would have been fine if there were not an intervening judgment that was signed and filed and contained the sentence for the defendant to begin immediately. It wasn't, the sentence wasn't held in abeyance.
Correct.
Everything kicked in as it should have, with the presumption that this is a final appealable
order. Because the defendant, Raber, was in college at the time, and there was a desire to have him serve his sentence over his winter break. By sentencing him at this point, he could serve his sentence over winter break, and then they could still revisit the issue of whether or not...
Okay, well, that doesn't... His vacation schedule doesn't trump the law on this.
Well, no, but there is, if you look, there's an agreement. The court does not include the agreement in its sentencing order. That's
and
clear.
That's part of the problem I have.
That's part of the problem
that
exists, correct.
What is that you didn't file any immediate briefs arguing that he was subject to the registration. So
correct.
No briefs were filed. The court files its entry with not any reservation. If the court had said, we reserve this issue, we would have a different story, and you don't appeal it, and you still don't file any briefs.
Correct.
And you only bring up the issue again because, allegedly, it's outside the record, but the families of the victim is concerned. So the finality seems to be there. Even though you may have had an initial agreement, nobody acted on it, and certainly you can't expect the defendant to act on that. It's not his obligation to seek his own registration.
Correct. I agree with all of that. But there's a simple clerical error in the order, which is it doesn't refer to the agreement that is clear on the record.
Who prepared that order?
The court's prepared. It's a form order that the court
is. The prosecutor didn't prepare the entry?
No.
All right. Let me ask you about the Court of Appeals decision. It's brief, and on page 3, the court clearly says, they talk about Claiborne, and then they say Claiborne supports the notion that a determination that a defendant is a sex offender, as is specified by Chapter 2950, constitutes a separate and distinct judgment from the judgment of conviction and sentence. And that seems to be the basis for their holding. If I'm reading it correctly, they're saying, well, this hearing and determination, whenever it occurred, is a separate case, starts a new clock with respect to appeal.
I think that's how the Ninth District decision reads, correct? I think you're correct on that. If your question is whether the state endorses that position,
yes.
I don't think it's necessary to affirm the decision below, because when you have a clear clerical error in the record like we do here, there was an agreement, and it simply wasn't put into the order, courts can take steps to correct that error. And here, that's what the court did.
Mr. Desiderio, the agreement that you call it, that what you just read to us at the beginning, it sounds as though the court was asking for an agreement for the continuance for briefs, to me.
You
talk about waiver, a voluntary relinquishment of a known right. I don't see where what you've just stated to us would constitute a waiver of any type.
Well, it wouldn't be that where the defendant's waiver came in. Where the defendant would waive the issue, excuse me, would be later. He shows up at the hearing with counsel. There's no objection to the hearing before the hearing. There's no objection to the hearing during the hearing. There's no objection to the hearing after the hearing.
And this is 11 months after the sentence?
11 months after the issue, right.
But if it's jurisdictional, no waiver is you can't waive jurisdiction.
Yeah, but our position is that it's not jurisdictional. There is an agreement. There is a clerical error in the order. The error has to be corrected.
What's the clerical error?
The clerical error was the failure to include the agreement that the registration issue would be put off to a later date.
That doesn't sound like a clerical error. That sounds like...
It is, because the agreement is clear on the record. They're going to decide the issue later.
If you file briefs to give the court guidance, which nobody did.
Well, there was no briefing schedule, and the order comes out less than a week later. So clearly the judge isn't sitting around waiting
for
the briefs.
The prosecutor can't say, Judge, what's our briefing schedule?
Sure.
Come on, you're sounding like the lawyers are sitting back on their hands, and they don't have the ability to keep the ball in motion here.
They could.
They could have, but they didn't. The state didn't.
The
defense counsel didn't.
Nobody did. You're correct. You're correct. And then the case is transferred. There's some sort of conflict in Judge Brown's chambers. It's not clear what the issue was. He transfers the case to Judge Wiest, and then Judge Wiest sets the hearing. But the court is within its ability.
Is there a motion for that transfer?
There's no motion for the transfer.
How does it get from one docket to another? We have an individual docket system that each judge is supposed to dispose of the case.
It's not clear in the record what. There's some sort of conflict, from what I can tell, in Judge Brown's mind about something. And so he transfers the case to Judge
Wiest. Is there an order of transfer that talks about a conflict?
I believe there's an order, but it doesn't go into much detail.
It mentions a conflict.
Correct. Correct. But it doesn't explain it. It just, there's a conflict, and it transfers to Judge Wiest. It sits on Judge Wiest's docket for a little while, and then he puts things back in motion. But the key issue here for the state is that the cases relied on by defense counsel all involve courts being asked to, or courts on their own, going back and changing something material that has already been decided. Here we have an issue that has not been decided, that was required to be decided, where the parties agreed to put off the decision to a later date. It gets put off far longer than I think anybody would have liked it to have been put off. But the parties agreed to put it off, and then the court goes and issues a decision on that. People knew that it was coming. The issue had not been decided. And the court was within its rights under cases like State v. Miller to take that action. And even State v. Lester, which was decided just last year, this court held that courts can correct errors in the judgment entries. And that's really what this is. There's a clerical error, which is the failure to put the agreement into the initial judgment.
Counsel, I'd like to have your thoughts on another aspect of this that came up in the questioning of the appellant's counsel. I think at the time that all this was occurring, there was an understanding under the case law from this court that this was a civil matter, the registration. And the statute refers to notice as opposed to imposing it as part of the sentence. But that appears to have changed, although the decision wasn't unanimous, that now this is punitive and therefore a criminal punishment. So why wouldn't this be treated exactly the same as post-release control? The sentence would be void because it didn't include everything it needed, and it just simply is a matter of resentencing.
You know, I think it could be. I think this is very similar to post-release control. When you have post-release control, you have often a series of obligations or requirements that defendants must follow, and this fits in line, I think, well with just being another requirement.
If it's akin to post-release control, then you do have to look at Hernandez, and Hernandez says once the sentence is already served, the court has no ability to impose what it missed on the first go-around.
But it didn't miss anything.
Well,
everyone agreed to put this off to a later date, and so it wasn't missed. Everyone was acting. Everyone agreed to put things off. The agreement occurred to Raber's benefit because he wanted to serve his sentence during his vacation schedule from school.
So
it's acting exactly how it should.
Under your argument, then, if 2 years had passed, that would still be okay.
You know, the longer we go, I think the more uncomfortable everybody gets with the timeline. But I don't think we need to draw a bright line rule in this case.
And the difference between this and post-release control is post-release control is set by law. Here, there had to be a factual finding to even get to the next stage, and there was a failure of proof because no one proved that factual finding to enable the judge to get to the stage of registration. Now, isn't that a difference between post-release control where, you know, this sentence automatically triggers this type of
I think this sentence was automatically going to trigger the registration. I think that
how there was no finding of consent, and that was what was required, wasn't it?
Well, that issue gets put off until a later date.
But that factual finding had to be made,
and
it wasn't automatic without a factual finding, was it?
I think the lack of consent is implicit in the charge to which he pled.
Then why did the judge need briefs?
I think at that point the law had recently changed, and there's, if you read the transcript just before the part that I opened with on page 6, there's a lot of confusion. The state is arguing that he must register. The defense counsel at the time, John Johnson Jr., is a very fine trial attorney in Wayne County, is arguing that there may be an issue under the new law with consent, and he wants a chance to explore that. But the final resolution is that non-consent is part of the charge. And in the briefs in this court, Raber seems to concede that and concedes the fact that at that sentencing, he should have been required to register as a sex offender.
So was the state going to just put this off indefinitely? I mean, had the judge, not sua sponte, set this for a hearing, the state in those 11 months never filed a motion for a hearing, never did anything to bring this recess, as you describe it, forward?
They did not. And I don't know why. There's not a good explanation as to why. It's a small office. They get very busy.
Perhaps they thought the case was over.
I don't think anybody thought the case was over because nobody objected to the new hearing, including the defendant. It's pretty clear defendant's trial counsel didn't think the case was over because he shows up and puts on arguments. He's very skilled and very experienced and didn't raise a single objection to the hearing. So perhaps he did not think the case was over.
But if we were to affirm, that would give the state absolutely no motivation to look at entries, to file motions with the court, but to put off forever, because in your view, the state always has the ability to have this imposed at a later time.
It has the ability to have it imposed in a later time where the parties agree on the record to put it off to a later time. This is a very unique and very rare factual situation. If the judge had issued an order, they don't talk about sex offender status. And then he issues an order that specifically says, doesn't have to register. Well, they would be locked in that situation. That's quite different. Here, this is a very unique set of facts where the parties have agreed on the record very clearly to put this issue off. It doesn't get scheduled. Would it have been better practice for the prosecutor's office at some point to realize on some calendaring docketing system that, you know, we've gone 3 months, 6 months. We haven't gotten this, we haven't had a schedule put in place. We haven't had a hearing. We should bring it up. That would have been better practice. There's no doubt about it.
Better practice have been to look at the judgment entry that the court is signing regarding sentencing?
Well,
and then file an appeal within 30 days if the sentencing doesn't reflect either a consent to put off registration, which I'm not sure can be done, but if that were the case, the entry would say it. But the entry didn't reflect any so-called agreement.
There's no question that the best practice would have been to raise the clerical error in the entry immediately. There's no question that that's the best practice.
I don't know whether I would agree that this is mere clerical error. I mean, this is a substantive part of a sentencing entry. It's not like they got the number of months wrong or they got, you know, some other technicality that is referenced in a statute incorrectly, and then they had to have that error, you know, that language comport with the statute. That's clerical error.
I don't think
you
that
to say that we have this very unique situation where we're going to bifurcate a sentencing, and that's merely clerical error?
I believe it is. The court has to make a decision. It's required by the statute to make a decision on this issue, and it did not make a decision on the issue because the parties agreed not to make a decision on the issue at that point. It's not substantive. It doesn't go. It's not a decision on the issue. It is simply a procedural decision that they made. The defendant is still going to have time to present his case and present any arguments that he wanted to have. It simply sets forth a process which they're going to reach a substantive decision later. So that omission in the order is a clerical error. The parties agreed to put this off to a later date. The court didn't add it to its form order. I think that is, in my opinion, most definitely a clerical error.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Todaro, your co-counsel has used all your time. You can have 30 seconds.
Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor. May it please the court. The state's brought up some interesting arguments, agreements, waivers, all subject matter jurisdiction doesn't allow for. It's clear subject matter jurisdiction is well-settled law in the state of Ohio. It does not allow for those. The other argument brought up was that this was a clerical mistake. Clerical mistakes are clerical in nature. They do not involve judgments or determinations. And in this case, the trial court made a judgment. They made a determination not to include a registration.
Counsel, isn't this the essence of this, whatever the legal consequences are, invited error? I mean, it sounds clearly like there was an agreement to postpone this because the defendant wanted to serve the sentence during vacation. They couldn't kind of decide right on the spot what this was, and so there was sort of a general agreement to just defer this so he could begin serving the sentence, and now it's sort of like, gotcha.
I don't believe it's invited error, Your Honor. Thank you for that question. What I believe it occurred here is there was discussions a week before the order was journalized. The trial court asked for briefs. No briefs were submitted. The trial court made its determination, therefore removing it from a clerical error. There was a judgment made, a determination. The conclusion has to be the trial court concluded, we're not going to have registration here. That's what occurred. And all of the agreements and all of the waivers that the state brings up at this point clearly do not pass through subject matter jurisdiction. They
counsel,
do not recreate it. I'm sorry.
Counsel, was the hearing to determine whether or not this was consensual and therefore subject to registration, was that mandatory?
I do not believe it was mandatory. It was it came about because the mens rea required in this particular charge is not consent, it's recklessness. The law, however, the statute includes consent. If there is consent, then there is no registration. And what the conclusion here was by the court, what has to be concluded is there was no registration required.
Here's my concern is that they agree that they're going to put it off and have the hearing at a later date. And then the judge asked for briefs on the issue, and no briefs are submitted by either side.
That's correct.
So at that point, the judge makes a determination and puts out the sentencing order, correct?
He puts out the final order.
And
that's correct.
It is silent as to the sentence or the registration requirement. Why can we not read that as the judge's determination that sentence or that registration was not required?
That's the way you should consider it. It was not required. The judge made that determination.
Without a hearing.
Without a hearing.
And my question to you, was it mandatory that the judge have a hearing no matter which way he was going to go on the registration issue? Is that hearing mandatory?
I don't believe it was.
You don't know?
I don't know, Your Honor.
All right.
I'm sorry. I do not know that.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decisions. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.